Lecture number 10, the Sangha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. The Buddha's dispensation is founded upon three guiding ideals. These three guiding ideals or objects of veneration are the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. The Buddha is the teacher, the Dharma is the teaching, and the Sangha is the community of those who live in accordance with the teaching. These three are together called the three jewels or triple gem. They are called the three jewels because for one who is seeking the way to liberation, they are the most precious things in the world, rarer and more precious than the most valuable gem. So far, we've discussed the Buddha and the Dhamma. In this concluding talk in the series, we'll speak about the third jewel, the Sangha. The word Sangha means those who are joined together, thus a community. However, the word Sangha doesn't refer to the entire Buddhist community. It doesn't mean the totality of Buddhists or even the totality of those who are committed to the Buddhist path. The word Sangha signifies a smaller community within the larger Buddhist society. In particular, it refers to two such communities, making for two kinds of Sangha. One of these is called the Arya Sangha, the community of noble ones, also called the Savaka Sangha, the community of the Buddha's true disciples. The other is the conventional Sangha, the Samuti Sangha, that is the order of bhikkhus, of fully ordained monks. Theoretically, the conventional Sangha also includes bhikkhunis, that is, fully ordained nuns. However, in Theravada Buddhist countries, the full ordination lineage for women has become defunct, even though there continue to exist independent orders of nuns. These we'll discuss later in the talk. The Aryan Sangha is the community of noble persons, all those who have reached the supermundane paths and fruits. This Sangha consists of eight types of individuals joined together into four pairs. That's mentioned in the salutation of the Sangha. Yadidam chatari purisa yugani atta purisa pugala. The Sangha made up of the eight types of individuals joined together into four pairs. The four pairs are the person on the path of stream entry and the stream enterer, the person on the path of the once returner and the once returner, the person on the path of non-returning and the non-returner, and the person on the path of arhatship and the arahat. The path experience lasts for only a single moment, and thus the first type of each pair can only be found at that one single moment of the path. But because the mental structure of the person at this stage is somewhat different from that of the person at the immediately following stage, the stage of the fruit, he's counted as a different type. But for practical purposes, there are really four main kinds of noble disciples: the stream enterer, the once returner, the non-returner, and the arahant. What unites all these persons and makes them a sangha, a community, is that they all share a penetration through direct experience of the innermost essence of the Dhamma. All these persons have followed the Buddha's path to the heights of wisdom and seen for themselves the ultimate truth, the truth of the unconditioned. The experience that makes a person an Aryan disciple is called the arising of the eye of Dhamma. We all have physical eyes by which we can see forms. We also have mental eyes by which we can understand ideas intellectually. But what the Aryan person has that the ordinary person lacks is the Dhamma Chakru, the eye of truth, the penetrating vision that sees into the real nature of things, that sees right through the process of arising and dissolving of all conditioned things to the unconditioned element, Nibbana. By arousing the eye of Dhamma, the noble person has cut off the first three fetters, the fetters of personality view, doubt, and clinging to rules and rituals. Such a person has absolute confidence in the triple gem, in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. He can never point to any other teacher than the Buddha, or take as his guiding principles any other teaching than the Dhamma. He's been, in a sense, spiritually reborn, born with a noble birth. It is the profound experience of the Dhamma that makes a person a member of the Aryan Sangha, a true disciple of the Buddha. The status of the Aryan Sangha is not established by any formal act of ordination. It's not restricted to monks and nuns. Most members of the monastic Sangha are not Aryans, but worldlings, putujanas. And any person, monk or nun, layman or laywoman, who penetrates the Dhamma, who arouses the eye of Dhamma, immediately becomes a member of the Aryan Sangha. Laypersons living at home can reach all four levels of liberation, but those laypeople who become arhants, very few, and when they do so, they automatically renounce the household life and enter the monastic order. But to continue in the household life, they need a certain minimum of attachment, which is lacking when arhatship is reached. Those who become Aryans have entered the definite path to final liberation. They can never fall back to the level of a worldling. They've stepped beyond the ranks of the multitude, caught up in craving and ignorance, revolving in birth and death. They're now bound to reach full enlightenment and final liberation. The highest of the noble disciples is the Arahant. He is the one who will never come back to any form of existence, high or low. He has reached enlightenment right in this body. He's cut off all of his craving. He's extinguished all defilements. And he lives out his days in the bliss of liberation until, with the breakup of the body, with his passing away, he attains the final goal, the Nibbana element without residence. The Aryan Sangha is the jewel of the Sangha Ratana, in the highest sense. It is this Sangha that functions as one of the three refuges when Buddhists recite Sangham Saranam Gacchami. I go for refuge to the Sangha. They're referring to the Aryan Sangha, the community of noble disciples. The Aryan Sangha is absolutely necessary to the Buddha's dispensation. Whether Aryans continue to appear in this world or not, it's absolutely essential for the Buddha's teaching that it should turn out an Aryan Sangha, at least for some time. The reason the Aryan Sangha is so important is because it is the noble disciples who stand as living proof of the truth of the Buddha's teaching. The Aryans are the one who have put the teaching to the test, who practice the path and verify the Dhamma in their own experience. They are the ones who have accomplished the aim of the Dhamma. The Buddha's teaching aims at transforming men and women from ordinary people, from worldlings, into noble people, into Aryans, at bringing them to the stages of liberation. The Aryans show that the teaching is effective in accomplishing that aim. These are the ones who have reached the different planes of liberation and can speak about them from direct experience. They are the guides and models. In their own person, they encourage us to follow the path. Since they began as ordinary people like ourselves, but by practicing the path has risen up above the ordinary plane and reached the state of spiritual nobility. And through their own attainments, they can give effective instruction to others. Instruction that's not based on mere guesswork or book learning, but that's based on personal experience. The second type of Sangha, as we said, is the conventional Sangha, the monastic order. The monastic order is called the conventional Sangha because admission to the order depends entirely on the convention of ordination, which can be given to any properly qualified candidate. It doesn't require any special spiritual attainment, but simply a person who wishes to enter the order and is free from any of the conditions that obstruct ordination. The conventional Sangha, the monastic order, is not a jewel or a refuge in the highest sense. However, it is still a jewel in a secondary sense. In Buddhism, the monastic Sangha is regarded as extremely precious, worthy of deep reverence and respect. And this is so for two basic reasons. First, because the members of the Sangha continue to follow the holy life laid down by the Buddha in its fullness. And secondly, because the members of the Sangha transmit the teaching of the Buddha from generation to generation. They keep the Dhamma alive in the world. The Buddha established the Sangha in order to provide ideal conditions for reaching the Aryan state, for attaining enlightenment and realizing Nibbana. When the Buddha was still a bodhisattva, when he went out in search of enlightenment, he did so by first renouncing the household life, by becoming a monk himself. Then, after he attained enlightenment, he established the Sangha as the resort for other people who were seriously bent on dedicating themselves to the task of spiritual cultivation, of reaching the supreme goal, here and now. The bhikkhus who take ordination into the order are those who have followed the Buddha into the state of homelessness. They take on the Buddha's mode of practice, they wear his robe, and they live according to his rule. The Buddha laid down the brahmacharya, the holy life, as the way to deliverance. And the monastic state provides the optimal conditions possible in this world for living the holy life that was intended by the Buddha. Aryans do not arise only from the monastic Sangha, but it is those persons who become monks and nuns who have the best opportunities for practicing to reach the Aryan state. The second reason why the monastic order is revered so highly, as we said, is that the monks have the function of transmitting the Buddha's dispensation. They keep alive the practice, the way of life established by the Buddha. They show to others burdened by the cares of household life that it's possible to live a life of purity, of renunciation, of restraint, meditation, and realization. By training disciples, they ensure that the Buddha's dispensation is passed on from one generation to another so that it doesn't disappear from the world. By studying the scriptures, by teaching them, they preserve the verbal teaching of the Buddha. They make sure that it's spread and propagated for the welfare of others. For these reasons, the monastic Sangha stands as a field of merit, worthy of respects, offerings, and support. The story of the monastic order goes back even before the ordination of the first bhikkhu, to the time the future Buddha was a prince in the palace. When he went on his outside expedition and saw the old man, the sick man, and the dead man, then his mind was deeply disturbed and all of his confidence and household life was shattered. Then the fourth sight he saw was a contemplative ascetic walking peacefully through the town, wearing rag robes, with shaven head, carrying an armsful. And this man indicated to the prince, Siddhartha, the course he himself had to adopt to find liberation. And so when the night of his great renunciation arrived, the prince followed that man's example by cutting off his hair and beard, putting on yellow robes, and leaving the palace for the life of a mendicant. And his own practice in this regard has provided the model for the Sangha through the centuries. Each monk, when he goes forth, does so in imitation of the original renunciation of the Buddha. The actual formation of the Sangha took place soon after the Buddha gave his first discourse. When the Buddha had finished explaining the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Noble Path to the five ascetics in the Dirpa, the oldest of the five ascetics, Kandanya, gained the first stage of enlightenment, the stage of stream entry. After he had seen the Dhamma for himself, he bowed down to the Buddha and acknowledged the Buddha as his teacher. And then he asked the Buddha to ordain him as his disciple. He wanted to become a monk under the Buddha. The Buddha then ordained him simply by saying, "Come, Bhikkhu, the Dhamma is well proclaimed. Live the holy life for the complete ending of suffering." Thus, with these words, Kandanya became the first Bhikkhu, the first monk disciple of the Buddha. But one Bhikkhu doesn't make up a Sangha. The Sangha is a community, and that means, in formal terms, a minimum of 4 months required to constitute the Sangha. But on that occasion, the Buddha continued to explain the Dhamma to the other 4 ascetics, who were named Bhadya, Mahanama, Vapa, and Asajji. And when they gained stream entry after his talk, they also asked to become bhikkhus under the Buddha, and the Buddha admitted them with the same words. When the Buddha accepted them as bhikkhus, at that very moment, the Sangha was formed for the first time, a community of 5 monks headed by the Buddha. Shortly after that, the Buddha taught them the truth of anatta, of egolessness. And at the end of this discourse, the 5 monks achieved enlightenment, destroying all defilements, and became arhats, fully liberated in mind. In the months and years ahead, the Sangha continued to expand very rapidly. And the reasons for its rapid growth are not so hard to understand. The age in which the Buddha lived was a period when spiritual ideals occupied first place in the scale of human values. It was not like a time like our own time in which material values are predominant. However, in the time of the Buddha, the prevalent religions failed to meet the spiritual needs of the people. The religion of the Brahmins was bogged down by superstition, ritual, sacrifice, and by artificial distinctions based on caste. And the non-Brahminic religious orders were given up to either extreme asceticism or to dry speculation. In contrast to all of these other teachings, the Buddha offered a clear and direct path to the highest goal, a path that was completely in accordance with reason, that was open to personal verification, and that was very appealing in its simplicity and in its practicality. And so many young men, from even from the highest classes, were drawn to the Buddha and wanted to lead the monastic life under his guidance. We shouldn't think that these young men which came only from the poor and the downtrodden. To the contrary, most of them came from the higher social classes. They included the young Brahmins, the sons of wealthy merchants, aristocrats, princes, also kings, farmers, and also those who were less fortunate, since the Buddha didn't make any class distinction. It included outcasts, poor people, beggars, and so on. The order grew very rapidly, and by the time the Buddha passed away, it contained thousands and thousands of members, and it was spread out throughout a good part of northern India. The key move which characterizes the act of becoming a monk is renunciation. The initial act of entering the monastic order is called pavaja, which literally means going forth from the household life into homelessness. Over and over again, we read in the Buddhist texts that some householder or a young man, after listening to the Buddha explain the Dhamma, gains confidence in the master. When he gains his confidence, he reflects upon the household life, thus, in the words of the text, he thinks, the household life is confining, a path for the dust of passion. The homeless life is free as the open air. It's difficult, while living at home, to lead the pure and perfect life of homelessness. I'll cut off my hair and beard, put on the saffron robes, and go forth from the household life into homelessness. Then we read that sometime later, that same person leaves his circle of relatives, whether they be large or small. He leaves his accumulation of wealth, whether it be large or small. He cuts off his hair and beard, puts on the saffron robes, approaches the order, and takes ordination, entering the life of homelessness. Now, there are some people, especially in the West, who admire the Buddha and his teaching, but find themselves put off by the Sangha. They feel something repellent in a religious system that issues in monasticism. They prefer to see a spiritual path that can be adapted to life in the world, rather than one that leads away from worldly life into monastic life. Now, such people might be justified in wishing to see a Dhamma that can be practiced in the world. And this is true also about the Buddha's teaching, that it's applicable for those who are living in household life. But anyone who's correctly grasped the drift of the Dhamma, the Buddha Dhamma, will see at once that the path of renunciation follows from it with complete naturalness. The Buddha teaches that life in the world is inseparably connected with dukkha, with suffering and unsatisfactoriness. Worldly existence is a round of becoming, leading us again and again into birth and death, and into all the different forms of suffering. And the reason we remain bound to the wheel of becoming is because of our attachment to it. We hang on to it through our craving, a desire for pleasure, for power, for continued existence. To gain release from the round, we have to extinguish our craving. And that is the highest renunciation, the ultimate act of renunciation, the inner act of finally cutting off all attachments, even the most subtle. But to win through to that attainment, we generally have to start with simple, common, relatively easy acts of renunciation. And as these gather force, they eventually lead us to a point where we no longer feel attracted to the lures of secular life, where our desire to be free from the bondage of worldly life overpowers all desire for the pleasures of the world. And when this happens, we become ready to leave behind the household life, to enter upon the homeless state in order to devote ourselves fully to the task of removing the inner subtle clingings of the mind. The homeless life is not absolutely essential to this work. True renunciation is an inner act, not a mere outer one. But as we said before, the homeless life provides the most suitable outer conditions for practicing true renunciation. Conditions which are helpful for most people, even if they're not indispensable for everyone. The holy life requires purified conduct, but household life stimulates many desires that run contrary to pure conduct. The homeless life is a life of meditation, calling for constant mindfulness, clear awareness, and contemplation. All this requires time, a calm environment, freedom from external pressures and responsibilities. It's difficult for those living the family life to find the leisure and opportunity to devote themselves single-heartedly to the work of spiritual development in its highest aspects. To provide such an objective situation, the Buddha founded the Sangha, a community of men and women who can live together in a spirit of harmony and mutual support, devoting themselves to the practice of the Dhamma. The bhikkhu, the Buddhist monk, it should be said, is not a priest. He does not function as the intermediary between the laity and any divine power, not even between the layman and the Buddha. He does not administer sacraments, pronounce absolution, or perform any rituals needed by lay people for salvation. The main task of the bhikkhu, of the Buddhist monk, is to cultivate himself along the path laid down by the Buddha, the path of moral discipline, concentration, and wisdom. Entrance into the Sangha, we should also say, is not binding for lifetime. One who becomes a Buddhist monk doesn't take lifelong vows. In some Buddhist traditions, especially in Sri Lanka, it's expected that those who take the higher ordination as bhikkhus will remain in the robe for life. But it's not absolutely essential, and if a person takes ordination and finds he's unsuited for monastic life, he's free at any time to leave the robe and return to lay life without any kind of religious blame attaching to him, without incurring any kind of obstruction to his spiritual progress. In other countries like Burma and Thailand, it's customary for just about all males at some time in their life to take ordination for a short period in the Sangha. In Thailand, generally for one rainy season of 3 months. After that, the young man is considered to be a fit candidate for marriage. In Burma, it's customary for many young children, young men, young boys to take ordination as novices, and for older men, after they've lived their full life, to enter the order in old age. The distinctive marks of the bhikkhu in all the Buddhist countries and most Buddhist traditions are the shaved head and the saffron robe. As it says in the stock passage that we already read, he shaves off his hair and beard, puts on the saffron robes, and goes forth into homelessness. Some people nowadays object to this distinct appearance of the bhikkhu, particularly in the United States. They think that the Buddhist monk has to change with the times, that he should conform to the society in which he lives. And so in this age and in this country, he should appear like everybody else, perhaps wearing his robes only when performing religious services or when teaching the Dhamma. However, these ideas do not accord with the specific nature of the bhikkhu's vocation. Even in the days of the Buddha, the bhikkhu had a distinct apparent appearance from lay people. His robe and his shaved head were never the common custom of the people. They always served to mark the monk out as different from others. The reason the bhikkhu adopts this appearance is rooted in the very nature of his calling. For one thing, the Buddhist monk seeks to realize the truth of anatta, of selflessness. And this means the relinquishing of one's claims to stand out as a special individual, to be a somebody. The aim of the bhikkhu is to become a man of naught, to reach total effacement, not in the sense of becoming a nameless nobody, but in eliminating the sense of ego, of self-identification. Now our clothes, our hairstyle, our beard, often become subtle ways in which we assert our sense of identity, by which we try to express our self-image, or to realize our personality. The bhikkhus seek to overcome this claim to self-assertion by adopting a mode of appearance that is the same as all other bhikkhus. They give up their individual color in order to blend imperceptibly into the larger body, the body of the Sangha. Also, the robe and the shaved head remind the bhikkhu of his special vocation. One of the themes for daily reflection the Buddha taught to the monks is to think, my way of life is different from that of worldly people. The common people flow with the stream of desires, of grasping, of becoming. The monk has to strive against the stream. He lives a life of restraint, self-control, and inner cultivation. Because the defilement in his mind might still be active, he often needs some special sign to remind him of his high mission, his calling to seek deliverance. The distinctive dress gives him that reminder. It lets him know that he wears the same robe that the Buddha wore, that he has the same appearance as the Buddha, and therefore that he should remain firm in his resolution to strive along the path of the Buddha. The special robe also serves another purpose, one which is directed outwardly towards others rather than towards himself. That is, the robe is the token of the Buddha's teaching. The monk represents the Buddha's teaching before the world at large. His manner, his conduct, his mode of deportment have the effect of impressing on others the fruits of training in the Buddha's discipline. If his conduct is pure and his manner is lofty, other people will be favorably impressed, and as a result, they will gain confidence in the Buddha's Dhamma. But in order for the bhikkhu to make others aware of the fruits of the Buddha's training, he needs a distinctive dress that singles him out as a disciple of the Buddha. And that is the reason for the robe. Another special aspect of the lifestyle of the Buddhist monk is that he lives in dependence on the offerings of others. He doesn't work for his living at a remunerative job. He doesn't receive payment in money for his religious services, but he lives entirely in dependence on the support of the laity. Those who have confidence in the Dhamma provide him with his basic requisites, his robes, his food, his dwelling place, medicines, and whatever simple material support he might need. The idea of a monastic order supported by the laity often causes trouble for people in the West. In the West, especially in modern America, we've been conditioned to believe that all capable people, at least men, ought to work for their living. We feel that it's morally wrong for an able-bodied man to live on the offerings of others. Sometimes it's asked what right the monk or nun has to ask for the support of his society, and what does the Sangha give the society in return? First of all, we have to say that the monks and nuns do not ask society for support. In fact, the code of monastic discipline
prohibits the monks from asking lay people for their material goods, except in the case of close relatives. The lay Buddhists offer the members of the Sangha their simple requisites freely, without any compulsion, without any pressure, without any sense of obligation forced on them. People give the monks the things they need as an expression of their faith in the Buddha's teaching. They give in the spirit of loving kindness, and because they want to help the monks lead the holy life profitably in order to reap its benefits. The monks and nuns who live in accordance with the Dhamma, these people are a blessing for the lay people who provide them with their requisites. And the benefits they provide can be found at several levels. First, at the most manifest level, they are able, by receiving the support, to become teachers of the Dhamma. Because they are freed from the necessity to provide for themselves economically, they can study the Buddha's teaching, learn it thoroughly, and then teach it to others. Through their knowledge of the Dhamma, they can guide others and teach others the principles that will lead to their spiritual welfare. Then, at a deeper level, the monks and nuns who receive the support maintain the tradition of Buddhist practice, especially the higher practices of meditation. They serve as an example for others. They serve as models of those who are pursuing the highest ideals. They show that the Dhamma is not just a set of abstract theories, but a real path that can be practiced. They inspire others to undertake the practice and lead them along the way to liberation from suffering. A third benefit the Sangha provides is to serve as a field of merit for others. The Buddha teaches that giving, or dana, is a source of merit, and the merit that comes from giving is proportional to the purity of the recipient. When the receiver is a person striving for enlightenment and liberation, the highest goals, they become the most fruitful field of merit. By making gifts to the Sangha of robes, food, and so on, the lay people gain merit that will sustain them in their own quest for liberation, which will bring them benefits in this life and in future lives. Perhaps the primary symbolic expression of the close relationship between Sangha and the lay people is the alms round. In the traditional Theravada Buddhist countries, especially Thailand and Burma, the monks acquire their food by walking from house to house with their alms bowls, gathering the offerings given to them by devoted lay people. When morning arrives, the monks put on their upper robes over both shoulders, they take their bowls, and they leave their monasteries. Sometimes they go individually, sometimes in small groups, sometimes in a long single file. They walk along silently and mindfully, without talking, their eyes cast down on the ground, their minds occupied with some theme for meditation. They keep the bowls beneath the folds of their robes. Then, whenever they pass a house where lay people have set up food for offerings, they stop, open their bowls, and silently receive what the people give them. After the layperson has given the monk his food, he usually bows down in respect, and the monk in turn will recite the short benediction, like Sukhi Hotu, may you be well, Ayu Vanu Sukhang Balang, may you achieve long life, beauty, happiness, and strength, and so on. As the monks walk along, they go to each house without making any distinctions or discriminations between rich and poor, between those who are generous and those who are thrifty. But he gives everyone the opportunity to make an offering and thus to gain merit. The monk does not ask for anything. He's not a beggar. He receives whatever is offered, and if he gets nothing at a certain house, then he just passes on. The rule, as we said, specifically prohibits begging. After the bhikkhu has collected enough for his day's meal, then he returns to his monastery. There, he'll take enough food for his own needs and share the rest with the other bhikkhus, the novices, and the monastery workers. In this way, the bhikkhu receives his material support, and the lay people gain the chance to practice generosity and to acquire merit. The practice of going for alms rounds is burdensome for none, and it's a source of joy for all parties concerned, the monks, the lay people, and the hands in the monastery who require the offerings of the monks.
There are two basic levels of monastic status in the Sangha, the rank of the Samanera and the rank of the Bhikkhu. A Samanera is a novice monk. A Bhikkhu is a fully ordained monk. The word Samanera means a little samana, or a little monk. A Samanera is one who has left the household life and entered the monastic fold, but he has not yet been fully admitted into the Sangha. He's still preparing for full ordination as a bhikkhu. He might have to undergo training for a period of several months or several years. So sometimes mature men who go forth are given the novice ordination and full ordination on the same day. The ceremony of becoming a samanera is called pabaja, the going forth from lay life into the homeless life. To become a samanera, the candidate must be at least 7 years old. He has to be physically fit, provided with robes, and he has to be accepted by a senior bhikkhu as a pupil. At the ceremony of ordination, the candidate approaches his preceptor with his head shaved and carrying his robes in his hand. He then asks the preceptor to be given the pabaja, the going forth. The preceptor will then give him a short explanation of what this involves. He takes the robes from the samanera, and then he gives them back. And this marks the acceptance of the candidate as a samanera. The new novice will then go off to the side, take off his lay clothes, and put on the robes. Then he returns to his teacher, and he asks the teacher to give him the three refuges and the 10 precepts of a samanera. The teacher will then recite the formula for the refuges and the 10 precepts, the samanera repeating them after the preceptor. And from then on, the samanera must observe the 10 basic precepts of the monastic life. These are first to abstain from killing or taking life, to abstain from taking what is not given, stealing. Third, to abstain from incelibacy. He has to lead a life of strict brahmacharya, of strict chastity. Fourth, to abstain from lying. Fifth, to abstain from using intoxicants, drinks and drugs that cause intoxication. Sixth, to abstain from eating at the wrong time, which means from midday until the next morning. The monks take their food between dawn and midday. From midday until the next dawn, they don't take any solid food, but only liquid drinks. Seventh, he has to abstain from singing, dancing, musical instruments, and from unsuitable shows. Eighth, he has to abstain from using ornaments, scents, garlands, and perfumes that beautify the person.